And welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, October 2nd, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and from the front page of today's Gazette, Bacteria and Algae Plague Iowa Beaches for Decades, by Brittany J. Miller of the Gazette, Monica Cordero, Investigate Midwest, and Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Backbone State Park stretches across 2,001 acres of northeast Iowa, featuring a lake ballooning from the Maquoketa River. There, visitors can swim, kayak, or simply lie on the beach during warm Iowa summers. The state park, Iowa's first, was built in 1920 on land donated by E.M. Carr, the grandfather of 82-year-old Mike Carr, who now lives in Manchester. Mike Carr can remember Backbone Lake in the 1950s, when it was the site of Red Cross swimming lessons and the hotspot for swimmers of all skill levels. It was just packed, he said. All the little swimmers were learning to swim inside the 5-foot mark. Those who knew how to swim, we'd always swim out to the big raft. Now, Backbone Lake has led Iowa lakes in swim warnings for bacteria over the last 14 years. Iowa ranks low for public land acreage, making its sparse public spaces and their beaches more attractive to residents. Iowa state parks have seen a 19% increase in visitation since 2000. Yet, year after year, public officials must warn against swimming at many of these public beaches because of poor water quality, despite state attention to the issue. The Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, for instance, was designed to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus loads in Iowa waters by 45%. A recent Iowa Environmental Council report found little progress has been made since the policy's adoption due to its voluntary measures. The Gazette collaborated with Investigate Midwest, a nonprofit newsroom based in Illinois and Iowa, to analyze two decades of beach monitoring data from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Sampling at about 40 beaches typically stretches from Memorial Day to Labor Day, depending on the year. We recorded how many times E. coli and microcystins, or human health risks in Iowa's waterways, surpassed safe standards in recorded water samples since the 2000s. We also discovered which state park beaches most often exceeded those standards. High test results can trigger beach advisories, encouraging visitors to stay out of contaminated water. After sharing our results with 5 water quality experts, we found that, although individual locations may display some progress, Iowa's beaches overall show little to no improvement in the past 2 decades. Some experts told us they were most worried about consistently high E. coli presence, while others found the unpredictable risk of microcystins more concerning. Localized restoration attempts have earned small victories, but to see widespread success, experts say Iowa farming practices, incentives, and regulations need reform. If there's anything that we can pull from this data, or any trend that we can identify, it's that we consistently have issues here in Iowa that are affecting our recreation opportunities and our quality of life, said Alicia Vasto, the Environmental Council Water Program Director. We need to be doing more to address it in ways that are actually going to make a difference. E. coli is a group of bacteria found in our intestines, food, and ecosystems. It's common in Iowa water bodies, originating from feces to wildlife, humans, or manure runoff from farm fields. Bacteria levels are typically higher after heavy rains that sweep the organisms from the shores into the water. Not all E. coli is harmful, but its presence indicates feces that can carry pathogens dangerous for swimmers who accidentally ingest it. As those numbers get higher, the risk of getting an illness from bacteria, viruses, parasites, and things like that goes up, said Dan Kendall, the state's lake and beach monitoring coordinator. The Gazette and Investigate Midwest probe found E. coli has a constant and bountiful presence at Iowa beaches. A fifth of monitoring tests administered since 2002 have exceeded the state threshold, which is 126 units of bacteria per 100 milliliters of water. This summer, samples topped that threshold 142 times, compared to last summer's 126 exceedances. The E. coli results are probably most concerning, said David Swiertny, director of the University of Iowa Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination. The data over time is pretty consistent and shows we aren't making much progress over 2 decades toward improving water quality at our beaches. The most notorious repeat offender by far is Backbone Beach. In 2 decades of data, we found its annual geometric mean of E. coli levels exceeded the state threshold in 14 of the 20 years. The geometric mean is a type of average used to dampen the effect of very high or low test values. One of the suspected reasons the lake has poor water quality is because 86,000 acres of farmland drain into a 50-acre lake. But unlike many impaired water bodies, Backbone has never had a total maximum daily load study, which is a water quality improvement plan designed by the DNR. That's because of its unique ecosystem along a river, Kendall said, which leaves it difficult to tell exactly what and where the E. coli sources are. If you've ever seen a lake that looks like pea soup, that's most likely an algal bloom. Microcystins are toxins produced from certain types of harmful algae blooms. These blooms depend on warm, stagnant waters and nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus. Unlike E. coli, algae blooms are observed more during times of drought and grow better in clearer waters. Since algae blooms are heavily influenced by climatic factors, they are often unpredictable. That irregularity was mirrored in our data analysis, where we found microcystin exceedances in Iowa lakes have risen and fallen since 2006. In 2012, for instance, microcystin levels surpassed the state threshold, 8 micrograms per liter of water, 50 times. That peak coincided with Iowa's most intense period of drought since 1988. This summer, microcystins topped safe levels only 11 times, but as climate change continues to threaten more frequent droughts, to the point where state officials expressed interest in creating a drought plan this summer, experts are concerned about the growing threat microcystins may pose. As temperatures increase and nutrient levels continue at high concentrations, the conditions for blue-green algae to thrive and produce toxins will also continue, said Marty St. Clair, a chemistry professor at Coe College in Cedar Rapids and director of the Coe Water Quality Laboratory. To make lasting change, experts agree we need to reduce nutrients and sediments flowing into the lakes. This means better identifying, regulating, and controlling root causes of the contamination. Others say best management practices for farming should be required instead of voluntary. It's important for people to understand and recognize that the opportunities to get outside, recreate, and enjoy natural places here in Iowa are really limited, Vasto of the Iowa Environmental Council said. I just encourage everybody to be a voice for these places, for our natural areas, and for our public beaches. And turning to the Iowa Today and News Track, catching up on an earlier story, investigation continues into death of CR woman by Emily Anderson of the Gazette. Background, Caitlin A. Marquez, 23, of Cedar Rapids, was brought to the Mercy Medical Center emergency room in Hiawatha on September 7th. She was not breathing and was pronounced dead. Hiawatha police determined events leading to her death had happened in rural Marion, and the investigation was turned over to the Linn County Sheriff's Office. Marquez had no obvious injuries, and an autopsy was performed September 9th at the State Medical Examiner's Office in Ankeny, according to a Twitter post by the Sheriff's Office. What's happened since? Very little information has been released about Marquez's death or the circumstances that may have led to it. Linn County Sheriff Brian Gardner said in an email his office is waiting for the toxicology report or cause of death determination from the state medical examiner's office. A GoFundMe was started September 11th to help pay for a memorial for Marquez. Any remaining funds are to go to Marquez's one-year-old son and his father, Tyler Evans, who is the boy's sole caretaker, according to the GoFundMe page. Katie was only 23 years old when she was taken from us, but boy did she touch a lot of lives in those short 23 years. Shannon Wiggins, Marquez's cousin, stated on the GoFundMe page. She was a beautiful person inside and out, always had a smile on her face. No matter what the situation was, she was very loving and caring and got along with everyone she met. All she ever wanted in life was to be a mother. She was finally given that opportunity and had a handsome baby boy, Jace, who just turned one in June. She loved that little boy more than anything. She also leaves behind Jace's father, Tyler, her mother, Debbie, 4 siblings, and a ton of other family who love her so very much and are devastated. As of Thursday, the GoFundMe page had raised $2,160 for the family. And the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state under the heading In the News, $2 billion state surplus. Iowa has a state budget surplus of nearly $2 billion, 54% more than its record-breaking surplus last year. Also, Iowa's cash reserve fund contains $830 million, and its taxpayer relief fund has more than $1 billion. The state's tax income from corporations surpassed $850 million, triggering a reduction in the state's top corporate tax rate from 9.8% to 8.4%. Governor Kim Reynolds celebrated the surplus this past week, saying it proves the effectiveness of the tax cuts she championed in the legislature this year. Democratic legislative leaders said the news was a windfall to corporations rather than working Iowans. Tax cuts passed this year will cut the state's revenue by $1.9 billion annually after 5 years. By 2026, all Iowans will pay a tax rate of 3.9% regardless of income. Fetal heartbeat bill. The state of Iowa argued the Iowa Supreme Court should reinstate the 2018 fetal heartbeat law and has the authority to do so. The law would make abortion illegal at 6 weeks, when supporters say cardiac activity is detectable in the fetus and opponents say it's before many women know they're pregnant. Alan Ostergren, a conservative attorney representing the state, argued in a brief filed last week that the injunction that stopped enforcement of the law was no longer valid because it had been based on precedent that has since been overturned at both the federal and state level. First District Debate. The candidates seeking to represent Iowa's 1st Congressional District traded barbs over abortion and inflation, but also pitched themselves as moderate bipartisans open to working across the aisle in a PBS debate on Monday. Christina Bohannon, a Democratic state representative from Iowa City, said President Joe Biden's student loan forgiveness plan was misguided and expressed a need to secure the southern border. U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, the incumbent Republican, said she had sponsored 13 bills that had been passed into law, demonstrating her willingness to work within the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives. Racist ad. Democrats called a campaign ad from Republican Governor Kim Reynolds racist last week. The ad shows Missouri Democratic U.S. Representative Cori Bush, a black woman, advocating for defunding the police. Reynolds' Democratic opponent, Deidre DeGeer, is a black woman but does not support defunding the police. Democrats said the ad drew a comparison where none exists and was based on stereotypes. Reynolds' campaign said the ad contrasts Iowa's policies with policies supported by Democrats in other states. Under the heading, They Said, the campaign ad contrasts the failed policies supported by liberal Democrats across the country with the common-sense leadership of Governor Reynolds. Pat Garrett, Governor Kim Reynolds' campaign spokesperson on Reynolds' latest re-election ad. None of what she said was founded in this state, and it's unfortunate. Honestly, I think it's short-sighted and lazy. But it's also unfortunate. What she showed Iowans was a figment of her imagination, not what Iowans need for them. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Deidre DeGeer on Reynolds' ad. Under the heading Odds and Ends, millions dedicated to opioid treatment. Iowa will receive more than $9 million in federal funding to target opioid treatment and prevention. The state estimates at least 1,100 Iowans will receive treatment and/or recovery supports during the next 2 years from the grant, and another 11,000 will receive prevention and harm reduction services. Ag gag law nixed. A federal judge has struck down the third attempt by the Iowa legislature to stop animal welfare groups from secretly filming livestock abuse, finding once again that the law passed last year violates free speech rights. The decision Monday rejected the law approved by Iowa lawmakers in April 2021 that makes it a crime to trespass on a property to place a camera to record or transmit images. The law, which had support from Republicans and some Democrats, made the first offense punishable by up to 2 years in prison and subsequent offenses a felony. Iowans in capital attack. Two Iowans are facing consequences on charges related to the January 6th U.S. Capitol riot. Doug Jensen, 43, a construction worker from Des Moines, was convicted of 7 charges, including civil disorder and assaulting and resisting or impeding an officer. Jensen was seen in photos and videos wearing a T-shirt affiliated with the QAnon conspiracy theory and was accused of leading the mob and weaponizing it by a prosecutor. Kyle Young, 38, of Redfield, was sentenced to 7 years in prison, one of the longest given to date. Young admitted to aiding the assault of D.C. Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone, which Fanone said ended his career as a police officer. Under the heading Water Cooler, COVID-19 cases continue to drop. Iowa's new COVID-19 cases fell for the fourth consecutive week as the state reported 2,091 new cases in the week ending on Wednesday, down from 2,908 the previous week. The number of patients hospitalized also fell from 219 to 179 in the same week. Senate debate. Incumbent U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley and Democratic challenger Mike Franken will debate on Iowa PBS at 7 p.m. Thursday. Grassley is seeking his 8th term in the Senate. Franken, a retired Navy admiral from Sioux City, is making his second run for the Senate after running in the Democratic primary in 2020. And turning to the Insight page, we have a guest column, Fit to Print, from Mary McCarthy, who lives in Coralville, an ode to newspapers for National Newspaper Week. My need for a daily newspaper must be genetic. Both sets of grandparents always had current newspapers in their home, back pocket or lunch bucket, as they struggled during the Depression era to raise families, crops, and livestock. That tradition continued in my childhood home. Our mother said that early mornings with her coffee and daily newspaper were a holy hour. When my maternal grandmother began to lose her vision, myself or a sibling made the 6-block walk every Thursday afternoon to read aloud her letter from home, also known as the Beresford Republic, a South Dakota newspaper. Reading duties were rewarded with Lorna Doone cookies and milk. Unfortunately, daily broadcasts of local newspapers, as provided by IRIS, Iowa Radio Rating Information Service, were not available. Newspapers have continued to be a companion. During the COVID cave time, my daily Gazette was not a luxury, but a necessity. My carrier is faithful. When there is a delivery delay, I find myself wondering if her van had mechanical troubles or if she fell on an icy step. Fussing over the newspaper delivery time was long ago reframed as my brother and I shared a paper route. Once we arrived at our newspaper drop site and discovered that someone had set the piles of newspapers on fire, our wagon broke under the weight of a Sunday edition. Things happened to prevent timely newspaper delivery. The September remembrances of carrier Johnny Gosh's disappearance highlight the perils of delivery. I still depend on a daily print newspaper as one of my information sources. Screen time is not ideal for a tactile learner. Critiquing purpose, grammar, and style are part of my reading time. Years ago, Lyle Muller, former Gazette editor, told me when journalists get feedback on an article, they know someone read their work. Within the past few weeks, I've heard national and local journalists talk about their craft. Several noted the increase of scary threats against them, as well as threats to discontinue reading newspapers. I always chuckle at writers who send letters to the newspaper saying they have had it with the editorials or commentary, and they are discontinuing their readership. Typically, within a month or so, there is another letter to the editor from the person who swore to quit. Do I always agree with what I read on an editorial page? No. Can I handle reading diverse thoughts and opinions? Yes. Do I try to learn from others' commentary? Yes. Do I look for facts? Yes. Is my money well spent on a newspaper? Yes. Do I have time to read the newspaper? Not always, but I try to peruse and I cut out columns to read when time permits. Like the merchandise at Ray Gun Store says, America needs journalists. However, I amend that slogan to America needs good journalists. From attending 2 Okoboji writers' retreats, I have learned there are many decent, dedicated, and thoughtful journalists in Iowa. Yes, some of the best have written or edited the content of the newspaper you are reading. October 2nd to 8th is National Newspaper Week. Think about your news sources. If a local newspaper is not one of your sources, you are missing much. Althea Cole's column, To a Candid World, Setting the Record Straight, Ruffled Feathers and Mischaracterizations Cast Shadow on Democrat Leader's Award. The Iowa Democratic Party is set to recognize the leader of the Linn County Democrats at its annual Hall of Fame celebration in Des Moines this afternoon, much to the anger of one Democratic activist in Lee County. The activist, Jennifer Hauf of Keokuk, has a point. Brett Nils of Marion is receiving the honor of Outstanding County Chair less than a year after a political action committee headed by Nils improperly coordinated with a Cedar Rapids mayoral campaign to produce a campaign mailer for last year's election, and only months after Nils and the candidate, Amara Andrews, were each reprimanded and fined by the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board for their roles in the coordination of the dubious campaign mailer. One can opine that it's a bit odd for such an honor to be given so close to the occurrence of such an infraction, as I explained to Nils when we spoke last week. Understandably, he wasn't pleased that I was revisiting the issue months after its conclusion, but mistakes like last year's fiasco can negatively affect local political engagement when efforts of local volunteers get marred by others' shenanigans. Hauf contends that this was her experience. She was queried in the Andrews PAC investigation due to the PAC sharing the same name of a local Facebook page she ran called Iowa Voter Info, and claims to have dealt with inquiries from the media, the Ethics Board, and the Federal Election Commission as a result of the shared name, and because the paperwork Nils Iowa Voter Info PAC submitted to the FEC mistakenly listed the email Hauf used for her Facebook page. The Iowa Voter Info PAC, for which Nils was designated agent, wasn't actually formed to help candidate Andrews. It had been conceived over the summer with the intent to inform voters about the records of federal GOP officials such as Ashley Hinson and whatever allegedly evil action she was taking as Congresswoman for Northeast Iowa, hence the intent to register with the FEC. By autumn, it was hurriedly decided that Iowa Voter Info would be used to inform Cedar Rapids voters about the allegedly evil Tiffany O'Donnell, obviously perceived as Andrews' most threatening opponent in the mayoral race. Money was improperly transferred between the Andrews campaign and the Iowa Voter Info Pact, which hadn't yet filed any paperwork. Templates used by the Linn County Democrats were hastily used to craft anti-O'Donnell mailers. One mailer landed in the mailbox of a skeptical opinion writer who researched and wrote about it with the proverbial, you know what, hit the fan. So yeah, Nils shared culpability for a big screw-up, or rather a series of them. He admitted his errors, demonstrated remorse, and was held accountable. The facts of the improper coordination between the Amara 4CR campaign and the not-yet-filed Iowa Voter Info Pact were litigated extensively in the media, on the ballot, and through an investigation by the Ethics Board. Helf sought to add her perspective to the story by submitting two guest columns to the Gazette. One was printed last December 1st after the mayoral campaign concluded. The other was sent to the editorial inbox last month after Helf learned of Nils' selection for the Iowa Democratic Party Award, which is what prompted my revisiting of the subject today. The latter of Helf's two submissions made claims that cast Nils as a lying crook, which I found jarring given his immediate willingness to face the consequences. Multiple attempts to follow up with Helf by phone and email were unsuccessful, leaving Gazette editorial staff with limited to no ability to verify other claims in the submission that alluded to malicious intent. Accordingly, an editorial decision was made to not publish it. Given the severity of the unverified claims, I decided to also review the original column of Helf's, which printed last December, before I joined the Gazette as regular staff. Admittedly, I hadn't read the column very closely at the time. An online version was never made available on the Gazette's website, but remains on the archived digital copy of that day's print edition. The story of the Andrews Iowa Voter Info coordination was compelling enough by the facts alone, and only serves to be clouded by mischaracterizations that unduly malign those who've acknowledged their failures. I've determined that some of the statements in Half's printed column were exaggerated or inaccurate and in need of correction, including a claim that Nils and Susan Elliott Bryan, Secretary of the Linn County Democrats and custodian of Iowa Voter Info's records, decided to pin this on Helf and make her look like the villain. While Helf surely received some phone calls and emails, I've seen no evidence that Helf was ever facing serious scrutiny. In fact, the Ethics Board was made aware that Helf was not involved on the same day that the complaint leading to Nils and Andrews' reprimands was filed, according to an October 29th email. It's also important to note that Elliott Bryan reached out to Helf a whole month before her guest column printed to apologize for mistakenly listing Helf's email as the contact for the PAC. A copy of that correspondence provided by Nils shows that Helf's email and the one that was set up for the PAC were nearly identical, save for only two letters, making it entirely plausible that Helf's email was used solely by accident. Yet Helf's commentary implies that her email was purposefully and therefore deceptively used on the PAC's forms, despite Elliott Bryan's earnest attempt to remedy the confusion. Therefore, I reject Helf's characterization that using the wrong email was a devious attempt to implicate her. Helf never acknowledged Elliott Bryan's attempt to contact her, let alone her apology. Ironically, Nils was more or less the only person culpable in the improper PAC campaign coordination to readily admit fault. Initially, Andrews and her allies, including paid campaign consultant Stacy Walker, also a Linn County supervisor, pleaded ignorance to my inquiries about improper coordination. Even after campaign finance documents were released, the campaign ducked and dodged, putting out statements claiming that they routinely supported the outside organizations interested in helping progressive candidates get elected to office. No other expenditures which could fit that description were listed on the Amara 4CR's campaign financial disclosures. Nils, on the other hand, took it on the chin, admitting during a televised interview with a local news station that he and his group had likely broken the law. When offered the opportunity to rebut Helf's editorial shortly after it printed, Nils declined, understandably opting instead to let the dust settle. That dust is kicked up a bit at the moment by an activist with an axe to grind and a journalist with a story to write, but I do not want my reporting to be used to misrepresent the facts in a way that unfairly smears anyone's character, especially regarding a story I am very proud to have broken as an amateur opinion writer. Does Nils deserve the award he's to receive this afternoon? State Democrats certainly believe so. I must admit that I've always viewed Nils' leadership of the local Democrat Party as far superior to that of his counterparts on the local Republican Committee, of which I am a member. Current Linn County GOP Chairman Justin Wasson tends to treat his position as party leader as a launchpad to run for higher office at the expense of his responsibilities to the committee, and well-meaning members have approached him behind the scenes to plead with him to step down. Every local political party, every volunteer organization at that, has its drama. Organizationally speaking, Nils' party, with him at the helm, boasts the more well-oiled machine. The records of even the best leaders have their blemishes, some of which can leave scars. That's important for all local and political leaders and activists to consider, especially in the final months of the current general election campaign. Nils is a good guy. I don't expect him to ping the ethics radar in the future. Instead, I hope the next devastating blow he's dealt is in the form of his candidates losing. I'm a Republican, after all, and this is still politics. And Todd Dorman's column, 24-Hour Dorman, Iowa Dems Push for Legal Marijuana. Iowa Democrats hope legal edibles can turn candidates into electables. When Iowa House Democrats recently unveiled their election agenda, it included legalizing marijuana. Democratic gubernatorial nominee Deidre Jagir also supports legal cannabis. Senate Democrats floated a constitutional amendment legalizing marijuana, allowing Iowans to vote on the issue. The pot push hasn't received much attention, probably because Democrats have such a slim chance of winning a legislative majority or defeating Republican Governor Kim Reynolds. Still, it's an interesting development on Iowa's political timeline. Legalization is increasingly popular in Iowa. In 2021, a Des Moines Register Iowa poll on the topic found 54% of Iowans favor legal marijuana. That's more than double the number of Iowans who supported it in 2013. It's often called recreational marijuana, but it has a serious side. Enforcement of criminal laws aimed at pot disproportionately affect black Iowans, even though marijuana use rates between black and white Iowans are roughly equal. Iowa's racial disparity in marijuana arrests is among the nation's worst, and it's a waste of law enforcement resources to enforce marijuana laws. I'm not pretending legal marijuana would be problem-free, but this is a state where we can purchase and carry a handgun without a permit. We can buy enough fireworks to turn our neighborhood into a war zone and blow off as many digits as we please. And we're never more than a few minutes away from places selling high-octane booze in large quantities if we want. The Iowa Freedom Gift Pack contains a handgun, a bottle of Templeton Rye, and a gross of Whistling Moon Travelers. Why not pot? Welcome to Iowa, I say. But for some reason, we continue to erect a Reefer Madness Maginot line against rolling up a joint. With Republicans in charge at the State House, we can't even talk about legalization. Decriminalization has a few GOP allies, but goes nowhere. Iowa's medical marijuana program is inadequate, and Reynolds opposes meaningful changes. I do not support recreational marijuana. I don't, Reynolds said in an interview in 2019. I won't be the governor to do that. Maybe it's cultural, with stoned liberal college hippies dancing in Republicans' heads. No upstanding Iowan needs to indulge in weed. A case of Bush Light or a jug of black velvet, maybe, but never pot. But like the real Maginot line, Iowans who want pot can simply go around it by driving to Illinois, where legal cannabis products are available. What the hell, Kim? Libertarian candidate for governor Rick Stewart says in his recent TV ad, touting his support for legal marijuana and opposition to the failed drug war. Here I am in Illinois, why, only a few miles from the Iowa border, and they've got legal cannabis. Dejere would legalize and regulate the sale of marijuana products to Iowans over the age of 21, similar to alcohol. She would invest an estimated $50 million in annual state tax revenue in four areas: education, mental health, paid parental leave, and substance abuse prevention. House Democrats also would permit the regulated sale of marijuana to Iowans over 21. But if the Republican trifecta remains in place, it will be a real bummer for pot fans. When people violate the law, they get arrested. When people violate the law, they pay penalties, Representative Stephen Holt, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, told Iowa Starting Line when asked about decriminalizing marijuana. How about legalization, Holt said. That is something I would never support. He's fun at parties. And yet Republicans are running on a freedom agenda this fall. But they just have a different notion of what freedom means. Under their definition, a person has the freedom to demand that their local public school conform to their individual worldview, from curriculum to books on library shelves. If that doesn't work, they should have the freedom to take public education funding and use it to pay for private school tuition. They believe in the freedom to sidestep public health directives during a pandemic, but women should be forced to give birth because abortion is severely restricted. Wealthy carbon capture pipeline developers should have the freedom to take Iowans' lands for their projects, paid for with billions in federal tax credits. A proposed amendment to the state constitution would make gun ownership a fundamental right while directing the courts to subject any law related to firearms to strict scrutiny. That will curtail the ability of Iowans and their elected leaders in the future from enacting new firearms laws. You might like to see your tax dollars spent to adequately fund higher education, public schools, mental health, and so on, but Republicans prefer having the freedom to sock away our billions, brag about a large surplus, and enact a new wave of tax cuts benefiting their donor class. And of course, there's the freedom farmers and landowners have to pollute waterways. So it's freedom for their ideological allies. The rest of us can love it or leave it. If Republicans continue to run the state like this, the least they can do is let us have legal marijuana to numb the pain. Edibles might help us forget that contemptibles. And turning to the community letters and the editorial cartoon from Joe Heller of Green Bay, there's a man standing on top of a drawing of the planet Earth. The planet Earth is on fire. Climate change, extinctions, war, pollution, and deforestation surround him, but he happily looks at the sky where he sees the DART mission moving the asteroid, the DART that NASA launched into the asteroid, and the man says, well, looky there, we can protect the planet. The first letter is from Ed Fisher of Iowa City. Resist retention of two Supreme Court justices. Vote no on retaining Matthew McDermott and Dana Oxley on the Iowa Supreme Court. Both justices were appointed by Governor Kim Reynolds and are on the ballot for retention this fall on the reverse side of the ballot. McDermott and Oxley are among the justices who this summer ruled that Iowa's Constitution does not protect a woman's right to abortion, contrary to earlier decisions by the same court affirming that right. Buried in their specious reasoning is this tidbit. The United States Supreme Court is expected to decide an important abortion case this term. We expect the opinions in that case will impart a great deal of wisdom we do not have today. We know how that wisdom played out. The lone dissenting justice, Brent Apple, who by Iowa law had to retire this summer, gave a lengthy and well-reasoned counter-opinion that included this bit of real wisdom. Constitutional liberties are often destroyed, not with a bang, but a whimper. I fear for the future of reproductive autonomy in Iowa. The majority today casts into darkness the hopes and visions of every woman in this country who had come to believe that the Constitution guaranteed her the right to exercise some control over her unique ability to bear children. Vote no on retaining McDermott and Oxley in November, and on the front side of the ballot, vote for Deirdre DeGeer for governor. Otherwise, common sense should tell you Reynolds will appoint new, like-minded justices. Ed Fisher of Iowa City. Next, Kathy Grayway of Coralville writes, Miller Meek's work ethic shows. Recently, KCRG ran a fact check on Christina Bohannon's baseless attack ad on Representative Marionette Miller Meek's and found it was untrue, giving it a D rating. This kind of behavior from Bohannon is exactly what is wrong with our political system today. Candidates should focus not on attacking their opponents, but focus on issues that actually matter to the voters. As a comparison, I have watched both of Miller Meek's TV ads, My Iowa Story and Hard Work. Let's compare Miller Meek's lifetime of accomplishments to candidate Bohannon. That would be a big wow. I am proud that Dr. Miller Meek's does not need to stoop down to cheap political shots, but instead chooses to highlight her strong work ethic. I have no doubt she will continue the work ethic she has had all of her life and do what is best for the people of Iowa in her next term. I am proud of having Dr. Miller Meek's representing us and plan to vote to re-elect her on November 8th. I encourage you to do so as well. Kathy Grayway of Coralville. Next, Garrett Fry of Cedar Rapids writes, support funding for independent living. Congress needs to reaffirm its commitment to 61 million disabled Americans by increasing funding for the independent living program and accepting the House of Representatives appropriations request of $140 million in the Department of Labor, Health and Human Services and Education and Related Agencies Appropriations Bill 2023. We are asking for the $140 million because there is an increasing need for services from Centers for Independent Living, which are cross-disability, non-residential, community-based, nonprofit organizations run by and for people with all types of disabilities. Centers for Independent Living help people live independently in their communities by providing services, including helping people to get out of nursing homes. I hope Senator Joni Ernst, Senator Chuck Grassley, and Representative Ashley Hinson will support their disabled constituents and accept the higher number requested by the U.S. House of $140 million for the Independent Living Program for fiscal year 2023. Garrett Fry of Cedar Rapids. Next, from Joel Snell of Cedar Rapids, stayed for Iowa House. My wife and I live close to a water tower between Glass Road and Shasta. The tower is rusting and scaling off loose paint. I made a few calls without success to get the tower repainted. Then I called State Representative Art Stade. Within 24 hours, he had all the information and indicated that the proper authorities will have it painted next year. I am voting for Art. Joel Snell of Cedar Rapids. Next, Phyllis Stockfleet of Marion writes tally for Lynn Treasurer. I am writing today to let you know what an excellent candidate I believe Paul Talley is. He is running for Lynn County Treasurer, which is becoming vacant for the first time in many years. I'm actually retired from there, so I know what kind of leadership it needs to excel, which is not a career politician. Paul has all the right stuff to make the changes the treasurer's office needs, both for the county and its employees. He has degrees in all the pertinent areas, is an honest, caring people person, and believes in strong, fair leadership. One of his goals would be to reduce spending while giving you a pleasant, efficient office. In this political climate, it is rare for someone to cross party lines, but I will for Paul. There is nothing political about this office, and he is the right candidate for treasurer. I invite you to learn more about him at his website, rallywithtallycampaign.com. Phyllis Stockfleet of Marion. And the final letter is from Barb Ferris of Hiawatha. Republicans want to end Social Security. On September 11th, Representative Marionette Miller Meeks held a fundraiser. Her guest of, quote, honor, end quote, was Republican Senator Rick Scott. Scott has a history of spending millions of his own dollars to win political races. From 2010 to 2018, the ultra-wealthy Scott spent more than $150 million on becoming Florida's governor and a U.S. senator. Earlier this year, Scott released his Rescue Plan for America. This very unpopular plan calls to sunset programs like Medicare and Social Security and force low-income folks to pay higher taxes. Every single Iowa Republican lawmaker was there, smiling with Scott. If you were a senior citizen or someone approaching retirement, this should be a wake-up call. Republicans have not made it a secret that they want to end Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid. Remember this when you vote on November 8th. Barb Ferris of Hiawatha. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, October 2nd, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Falgido, and we turn to today's obituaries. In the other notices, Philip James Louder Sr., age 83, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, September 29th, Tien Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. Richard Dale Siolseth, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Tuesday, September 20th, at St. Luke's Hospital, where he received wonderful care. He has been a resident at Cottage Grove Place Independent Living for the past 7 years. After graduating high school in Hills, Minnesota, Richard joined the U.S. Army and was stationed in Berlin, Germany during the Reconstruction. He eventually became coordinator of the Gifted Talented program for the Los Angeles County Unified School District. And in 2016, after living in California for 50 years, Richard moved to Cedar Rapids to be near family. Cremation rites have been accorded by Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service, Cedar Rapids. Interment will be at a later date in Bethlehem Lutheran Cemetery in Hills, Minnesota. Frank J. Riddle, age 78, of Cedar Rapids, died of natural causes on September 20th. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Donald Fred Valenta, age 90, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Traer, died Tuesday, September 27th, at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital. Funeral Mass, 10:30 a.m. Saturday, October 8th, at St. Paul Catholic Church, Traer, by Father Anthony Nikita. Burial, St. Paul Catholic Cemetery in Traer. Friends may visit with the family after 9:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. The family has requested those in attendance please wear a mask. Tien Funeral Home is serving the family. William Allen Weeks, known as Bill, age 77, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Friday, September 23rd. Celebration of life, 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, October 19th, at the Squaw Creek Wanatee Park, Red Cedar Lodge. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service of Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Bill drove truck during his working life in several capacities. He retired from driving at Forward Air. Bill loved cars. He was the proud owner of a 1937 Chevy Coupe. Bill belonged to the Cedar Valley Street Rods, Iowa Street Hot Rods, and was a member of the Eagles Club. William D. Bullock, age 87, of Vinton, passed peacefully on Wednesday, September 28th at Belle Plaine Specialty Care. Visitation will be held at 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Saturday, October 8th, at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel in Vinton. Interment will follow at 3 p.m. at Maplewood Cemetery in Vinton. Diane Cherie Ely, age 80, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Thursday, September 29th, at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, October 3rd at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids, with a vigil service to begin at 4 p.m. Funeral Mass, 10 a.m. Tuesday, October 4th at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Burial, Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Diane worked at Cedar Graphics and was a member of St. Patrick Catholic Church. Diane and Tom enjoyed attending car shows and car cruises together. Kenneth Allen May, age 82, of Marion, passed away on September 25th, 2022. Per his wishes, no services will be planned. Edgar F. Wise of Cedar Rapids, after battling Alzheimer's for several years, Ed passed away peacefully in his sleep the morning of Friday, September 30th. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Private interment will be held in the Garden of Reflection, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Ed enlisted as an electronics technician in the U.S. Navy. Ed and Edie moved to Marion in 1964, and Ed worked as a technical writer for Rockwell Collins for 32 years. Ed was an avid bowler and coach, holding various offices within the Cedar Rapids Bowling Association. He was a member of the Marion First United Methodist Church, volunteering his time and playing on their summer softball league. And Ed and Edie spent many years volunteering within the Marriage Encounter community in eastern Iowa. Lois M. Starks, age 82, of Central City, passed away on September 27th at her home. Per Lois' wishes, cremation has taken place and no open house or public funeral service will be held. The family will have private burial at a later date at Mount Clark Cemetery in Central City. Murdoch Funeral Home Cremation Service of Central City is assisting the family. Lois retired from Rockwell Collins after 32 years of service. After retirement, she went to work helping senior citizens in the Central City area for the next 25 years. Lois was loved by many, many neighborhood children who enjoyed coming to see Lois, baking cookies, coloring. She even took some children and their mothers to meet her second cousin, retired Baltimore Ravens guard, Marshall Yanda. Erica Lee Hempstead, age 41, of Center Point, died Thursday, September 29th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted the family. Erica was very passionate about helping others through education about nutrition and the many modalities of cancer treatments. She was an inspiration to so many and was a provider of hope for a better quality of life. She was very focused on doing all the things, not only for her own journey, but for anyone she came in contact with. Julianne Elizabeth Godar, born Julianne Elizabeth Kessler, age 75, went to be with Jesus on Sunday, September 25th. Julie enjoyed playing cards, crossword puzzles, watching General Hospital and Hallmark movies, Carlos O'Kelly's Chips and Queso, and her granddaughter, Georgie. A graveside service is set for 11 a.m. Friday, October 7th at Spring Grove Cemetery in Covington, Iowa. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Richard G. Rogers, known as Dick, of Summerfield, Florida, passed away on September 22nd at the age of 81. A mass of Christian burial will be at a later date in Monticello, Iowa, with burial in the church cemetery. Following 3 years in the U.S. Army, he was employed by AT&T for 36 years. He loved working with wood and enjoyed traveling throughout the United States and to Europe. He was a NASCAR fan and enjoyed watching college football. Ricky Allen Novak, age 67, of Cedar Rapids, took his walk on the stairway to heaven on Tuesday, September 27th, after a four-year battle with lung cancer and its complications. He decided at a very young age that music was his passion. He bought his first guitar after an entire summer of mowing his aunt's yard. Without one single lesson, he taught himself how to play. He traveled the Midwest with multiple bands as lead guitarist and singer, including the dearly departed Way Cool Jr., Spinnin' Jenny, Stone Garden, Max Static, and various others. He provided audio recording services to local artists and voiceover actors for many years. 2005, he retired from his band life and began recording his own music. In 2014, he opened Sounds by Novak DJ service after DJing multiple events across eastern Iowa. He ran that part-time until retiring in 2021. Rick requested no funeral services, but a celebration of life will be scheduled at a later date. Stuff is too sad now without him. Nancy Jean Becker, age 73, of Mount Vernon, passed away Monday, September 26th, at Hallmark Care Center in Mount Vernon. Memorial service, 11 a.m. Tuesday, October 4th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Mount Vernon. The Reverend Dennis Fulkerson will officiate. Burial will take place in the Campbell Cemetery west of Mount Vernon. Visitation, 10 a.m. to service time on Tuesday at the funeral home. Nancy enjoyed all types of gardening. Caring for her flower bed was always important. Nancy canned the products she grew. Throughout her life, Nancy was blessed with several devoted pet dogs. It was always very evident the dogs loved her. She sewed clothes, crocheted, and did needlepoint. Nancy was a member of the Mount Vernon American Legion Auxiliary. Inez Dolores Pulaski, born Inez Dolores Christensen of Bella Vista, Arkansas, passed away peacefully at the age of 95 on September 17, 2022. Inez and her husband moved to Cedar Rapids in 1973, where Inez and Jean ran a grain inspection business. After retiring, they enjoyed their time traveling the country, golfing, and building their home together on a lake in Arkansas. Inez enjoyed socializing, playing bridge, dancing, and bowling. However, her primary recreational passion was golf, and her proudest moment on the course was a thrilling hole-in-one in March 2001. The service will be at 3 p.m. Wednesday, October 5th at United Lutheran Church in Bella Vista, Arkansas. Kim Rule Shearer, age 70, of Elkader, passed away Friday, September 16th. A memorial service for him will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, October 8th. With a celebration of life service beginning at 3 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, Cedar Rapids. Marjorie Heinsius Troutman of Solon passed away suddenly on September 15th in Owosso, Oklahoma. She went to be with her Lord Jesus Christ at the age of 98 years. Public visitation will be from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, October 15th, at the Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center, lower level, located at 100 South Cedar Street in Solon, followed by a graveside service in Oakland Cemetery in Solon. Fellowship will follow at the Solon American Legion. And Phoebe Deborah Rachel Smith of Jackson, Mississippi, died September 19, 2022, in the early morning hours. Deborah went to work at Sherman Hospital as the first African-American nurse's aide and phlebotomist, where she met her husband. She and her husband raised their family in Cedar Rapids, and they grew beautiful gardens, hosted international students, mentored the African-American students at Coe College in Kirkwood, as well as many dignitaries over the years. She and her late husband were leaders in the civil rights movement in Iowa, and they started a movement encouraging interdenominational churches in the area to participate in the civil rights movement and social justice. They were among the founders of the African American Museum of Iowa. Vernon and Phoebe were campaign committee managers of the Jesse Jackson presidential campaign in Iowa. In Cedar Rapids, she worked at Collins Radio, Jane Boyd Community House, and Coe College. She volunteered for the Indoor Sports Club, American Business Women's Association, Religious Book Study Club, Criterion Club, African American Museum of Iowa, Mercy Hospital Kansas Center, and St. Dominic Hospital of Jackson, Mississippi. She was a member of Bethel AME Church and the former Knox Presbyterian Church of Cedar Rapids. Barbara Ann DeKlotz, age 91, of Marion, passed away September 24th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Memorial services will be held 11 a.m. Monday, October 10th at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, 915 27th Street, Marion. Pastor Andrew Noble will officiate. A celebration of life will immediately follow at Indian Creek Country Club, 2401 Indian Creek Road in Marion. Private burial service for family at a later date. Barbara worked at Collins Radio, retiring 33 years ago. She was a member of St. Paul's Lutheran Church and involved in many card clubs and various fundraisers in Delhi. She enjoyed anything with music and loved going to TCR musicals, watching Lawrence Welk reruns, an avid Hawkeye Anything fan, and was an avid bridge player. Turning to the sports page, unfortunately, both the Hawkeyes and the Cyclones lost yesterday. Mike Kloss writes, "Minus defensive magic, Iowa, not a show worth watching in Iowa City." It's amusing and amazing that the pink walls of the visitors' locker room of Kinnick Stadium still matter to anyone, but everything about this place is significant to Michigan football coach Jim Harbaugh. He spent a few of his formative years as a boy in Iowa City while his father, Jack Harbaugh, was an Iowa assistant football coach in the 1970s. He lost here as Michigan's quarterback in 1985 when number one Iowa beat the number two Wolverines on a last-second field goal. In his lone previous game here as Michigan's coach, The Wolverines were again ranked second and lost on a last-second field goal. Iowa was an 18-point underdog. That was 2016. So earlier in the week, Harbaugh didn't downplay from Iowa's success here over elite teams in recent years. He wanted it mentioned, wanted his guys fully aware of it, and motivated to avoid a similar result. "That's where top five teams go to die," Harbaugh said about Kinnick. Quite a statement, given his guys are ranked number four. And those pink walls? Michigan's players talked about them with glee after the game. They even waved pink towels on their sideline. "Let them know that we don't care," said Michigan quarterback J.J. McCarthy. "The pink locker room? Bring it right out to the field. Doesn't matter. Doesn't faze us." McCarthy was very good. Running back Blake Corum was very good. Michigan's offensive line was very good. The fourth-ranked Wolverines led 13-0 at halftime, 20-0 entering the fourth quarter, and went home feeling in the pink after the 27-14 win. Kinnick, where top five teams go to die? Not in 2022. The only thing Iowa's offense puts to sleep is the audience. The Hawkeyes had two touchdown drives. The second came after Michigan put the game out of reach, so that presumably is progress, but it wasn't the kind of offense to hang with a really good team in one of the games that are remembered when a season is over. Iowa, 3-2, is 0-2 in those against Iowa State and Michigan. The Hawkeye offense did have its best game of the season, aesthetically. Wide receiver Nico Reganis's return to health has made the passing game better. The overall unit, however, isn't good enough to win games when its defense doesn't force turnovers. "I think we're getting better up front," Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said. "I think we've got backs that are doing a pretty good job. I think we have two tight ends doing a pretty good job, and getting Nico back, all that stuff goes together. I'm not discouraged by our guys. In fact, I'm encouraged by some of the things I'm seeing. But we're going to have to keep moving and obviously have to get better." There was no defensive magic against a top-five team this day. Thus, there was no magic period. There were no pick sixes, no scoop and scores. Relying on such things to win is fine against a Rutgers, but it's a lot to ask against Michigan. The Wolverines came to this house of pain feeling no intimidation. They laughed at the pink walls and didn't tremble because of crowd noise or the vaunted defense wearing black. They established a vintage Michigan run game on its first drive and established themselves as the superior team. This wasn't the 42-3 humiliation in Michigan's hands that happened last December in Indianapolis, but it certainly didn't close all of that wide gap. Iowa didn't score until the fourth quarter had begun, folks. On 4th-and-2 from the Michigan 6 with the score 20-7 and about 6 minutes left, Iowa was called for offensive pass interference. The penalty was declined because the Hawkeyes had completed a pass for 1 yard. Ferentz has seen a lot of football and says he's encouraged. "We've seen a lot of his teams and know many got better in the second halves of seasons. The Big Ten West is there for Iowa's, or somebody's taking again this year, maybe with 3 league losses this time. But does that excite you? No, it does not. A university that offers majors in art, screenwriting arts, and theater arts charges Hancher Auditorium prices to see a football offense that Ferentz calls a work in progress, as usual. And finally, for the reading today, The Time Machine, a look at people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. World's first automatic hydroelectric plant operated on the Cedar from 1917 to the 1970s, by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. Cedar Rapids Electric Light and Power began offering electricity in eastern Iowa in 1882. By 1917, it had built and was operating the first automatic hydroelectric plant in the world on the river in Cedar Rapids. The company, by then known as Iowa Railway and Light Company, decided it wanted to augment its coal-fueled steam production of electricity with water generation. Recognizing that the old dam in the Cedar River was deteriorating, building a new one with an attached power plant made sense. So while the city built a new dam, Iowa Railway and Light built a hydroelectric powerhouse and penstocks, including retaining walls of the head and trail race, for a length of about 25 feet up and down the stream, the Gazette reported in June 1917. Penstocks are channels for conveying water to turbines. The finished structure on 1st Street at A Avenue Northeast was the first fully automatic water-powered electric plant in the world. Iowa Railway engineer and inventor John M. Drebels designed the plant to be run remotely from the utility's 6th Street Power Station in northeast Cedar Rapids without any employees at the Riverside plant. High water in the spring of 1916 delayed the start of the foundation work on the plant for at least 2 months. When work was fully underway, between 30 and 40 workers began the excavation of solid rock. More crew members were added when weather moderated. Crews completed excavation for the foundation in September. The site was turned over to the Fargo Engineering Company of Jackson, Michigan, which began construction of the concrete foundation. Above the concrete base, The building's walls were made of 17-inch thick Bedford stone. The main entrance on First Street and the windows were framed in steel. The interior measured 112 by 41 feet. Ornamental brown brick on the lower part of the interior walls was topped with cream-colored brick to the roof. 5-inch thick reinforced concrete slabs on steel made up the roof. 5-ply composite roofing was laid on the roof slab, while 4 750 HP water wheels attached to generators were ordered from the Alice Chalmers Company in Milwaukee. Only 3 were installed. The plant had room for the 4th, but water flow was never sufficient to justify it. The switchboard was furnished by the General Electric of Schenectady, New York. The generators could be started or stopped by merely pressing a button at the plant on 6th Street, half a mile away, or a control switch could automatically start the plant with the rise and fall of the river. Electricity passed through underground cables to the 6th Street Power Station. The station went into full operation on October 17, 1917, with an output of 20,000 kilowatts of electricity, about a tenth of the coal-fired production of the 6th Street Generating Station. The hydroelectric plant also generated attention worldwide. Engineers from all over the United States visited, as did engineers from England, Japan, France, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, India, South Africa, China, Chile, Peru, Ecuador, and others. Even some German engineers visited the plant after the armistice in 1918, the Gazette reported. Since the hydroelectric plant operated by remote control, any change in the Riverside unit would be known immediately at the 6th Street station. At one time, the plant ran for 6 weeks without anyone unlocking its doors. But the pioneering plant had become nearly obsolete by the 1970s, and urban renewal spelled its demise. Demolition began in August 1972, but not without incident. A 2-ton steel wrecking ball broke loose from a cable attached to a crane and flew into the river. By December, all that was left were the turbine wells below water level and the foundation of the building built into bedrock. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, October 2nd, 2022. The articles have been selected and lightly edited by me, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from my daughter's bedroom in Coralville. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recording at any time at our website, iowaradioreading.org. We welcome your comments, and thank you for listening.